Welcome back to a new day and a new week at the Damage Report. I'm Johnny Arola. It's Monday, and so Brooke is in studio.
Can you take a look down there?
Always red bar. Always red bar. It looks weird without it.
It's gotta be there. Cool. Look, we got a little fancier here.
Yeah, it's a little fancy. I'm sure people
hate it. Our eyes are right because we're looking at the big monitor in here, but I want you on your screen to look down and see how cool we are these days.
I can't wait to hear complaints about it.
No.
Anyway, this is just for me. The weekend was a little bit rough, and I have a feeling it's going to be one of those weeks. I understand we're going to talk about news. Blah, blah, blah. I got all these papers. There's stuff on them, and we're going to talk about it. Later on this week, Mueller's going to be testifying, and it's just everything. Everything is going to be awful as a result. I mean, what do you think tomorrow and the next day Donald Trump is going to be like? I mean, what insane thing is there is every reason to believe he's going to launch cruise missiles at Iran during that testimony to distract from it. I, in all likelihood, will not be here on Wednesday for that. I'm supposed to be doing like 5 hours of analysis of the testimony for KTLA, but we're gonna have fill-in hosts are gonna be doing an amazing job. Perhaps Brooke, actually.
You're not gonna be here tomorrow?
No, I'm gonna be here tomorrow. I'm not gonna be here the next day.
Sure.
But anyway, we're planning things. There's gonna be a lot of stuff, and it's just there's gonna be a Trump rally coming up, and you know he's gonna do the
chant. Did you say a Klan rally or no?
Exactly. You know what? Let's just get in the news because I'm having a hard time keeping it together today.
I know. Send John some positive thoughts, okay?
Well, I like to think that the breakdown I'm having is reflective of America.
Okay.
This breakdown brought to you by our political process.
So send him some positive thoughts from Mexico.
Exactly. Okay. So we're gonna jump right into it. Starting with, you know what? We're gonna do a little follow up to last week's insanity with Donald Trump.
Okay.
And that rally, actually. Trump would love to have you believe that last week it was all strategy. You know what? He wanted to take down these congresswomen, and so the whole send them back thing, send them home, all of that, that was just phase 1, 2, and 3 of a plan. And I was telling you all week that it wasn't. We find out from sources within the White House that it wasn't. So here, this is from the Washington Post. Take a look at this information. Trump's own campaign was caught off guard by the tweets and didn't know initially how to respond. So the idea that it had been a coordinated thing prepared in advance, that's simply not true. When he first got to the White House when he first meets with his people after waking up and laying in bed and watching Fox and Friends and tweeting about it, he was criticized by Kellyanne Conway. We want to know what is going on. And he defended himself. He'd been watching Fox and Friends after waking up. The president said he was interjecting himself and he thought it was in a good way. He acted alone, impulsively following his gut to the dark side of American politics. So this is coming from Trump insiders. Of course, anonymous, because as they describe in this piece, there is no incentive whatsoever to poke your head up and try to steer him in the right direction because he attacks you immediately. Even if you help him, he will remember you as having been disloyal rather than useful in some way. And so this is basically what happened. The day before those initial tweets on the golf course, he hadn't brought it up. Over the coming days, dozens of friends, advisors, and political allies would work behind the scenes to try to fix the mess without any public admission of error, because that was not the Trump way. Advisors wrote new talking points and handed him reams of opposition research on the four congresswomen, because their idea was, okay, he's going to focus on these four people. There is no use trying to get him to stop doing that, but maybe we can have him focus on particular lines of attack against them that are at least well researched and perhaps grounded in something reflecting reality rather than just lumping them together for racial reasons and saying that they should be sent out of the US. Of course, he did not use that stuff. Their mistake was assuming he would read, I think.
Yeah. You know, why was the idea that this was a strategy even being pushed as a way to kind of soften what he did in the first place? Because let's say that were true. If the only reason that racism would work as a strategy would be if your base likes racism. We know they do, but that doesn't make it any better. It doesn't matter. Do you know what I mean? Like, I was blown away that was such a talking point from so many people nationally, that this was just a strategy, that this was just racism as a strategy is just as bad as racism because just racist.
Yeah.
It's all bad. It's all the bottom of it all comes down to racism.
Yeah. There's sort of a false foundation to it where it's like you could say a racist thing because you believe it. Or you could say a racist thing, you don't believe it, but you think it'll help you politically. I would argue that if you're using that to help you politically,
you do believe you're racist.
Or
yes.
you're just generally a racist, I would say.
Exactly. I think both, that's my point. Yeah, both of them are coming from the idea that you just have to generally be racist.
But I think the reason, the retreat to it's a strategy, I think the reason different groups use it is different for each group. I'm gonna get into it, but here's AOC tweeted something sort of to this effect earlier this weekend, saying there are some DC strategists that seem quite eager, almost wanting to believe that Trump is a secret genius playing 3D racism chess. They're wrong. He's simply an impulsive racist, one who leaves his party scrambling to excuse bigotry and scam the country. So I think, look, people who genuinely like Trump and are probably racist, this particular group, they don't want to admit that, and so they have to say it's something else. They have a lot of respect for him, which they shouldn't, but they do, so they say it's a strategy. I think that people who despise Trump are so frustrated with the fact that he got into office that there's this like deep feeling that, yes, I hate him. He's obviously an idiot, but he's got to have some sort of strategy. He couldn't have just bungled his way into having more power than any other individual in the country. And so there's like this fear that he's a dark overlord and he's operating from this position of moving these chess pieces around. I don't think that that's actually been reflected in what he's done. And since he's been president, he's gotten a few of the things that he wanted, but he's also engineered his own destruction in a lot of different ways. I think it's a combination of fear for the left and, you know, like slavish devotion on the right that's led to that.
A lot, and you know, I hate the whole both sides phrase, but I think there are a lot of people everywhere who just like the racism. And Trump's racism isn't the only bad thing about him. You know what I mean? Like, so I think sometimes often when people excuse his racism from what you would assume to be an ally or someone on the left, it could just a little bit be because they happen to like the racism, they just don't like Trump.
Yeah, it's possible.
So then it becomes this conversation of, oh, well, that wasn't racist. We can't talk about that. We don't do that. You're gonna turn people into, like, do you know what I mean? Like, it's almost this like defending it, but also saying you hate him. And so I don't even know if I believe people are just afraid that he is secretly some dark, just genius overlord.
I think there's people on the left that think that he is, that he's got this plan, and so, that he's not just fumbling around. I think that
how do those people walk in straight lines?
I don't know. I think that it's just fear. I think that a lot of people see the amount of power he has, and you know, if someone has been able to accrue that much to them and is accomplishing such horrible things, the idea that that person could be a complete moron with no plan and yet is still winning politically, or at least is holding the office, is almost more frustrating than, you know, we've got this horrific guy who's, you know, making good on some plan. That's sort of understandable. I think that the other one is a little bit more sort of scary because it's chaotic. I don't know. In any event, I do know that he's been sort of day by day moving from one defense of what happened to the next, occasionally backtracking according to the media and then doubling down. And all of this is just, the clock is ticking on him leading the chant himself, and we're all pretending that that's not gonna happen. But this morning he tweeted, the squad is, he put it in quotes, just you can just say it, is a very racist group of troublemakers who are young, inexperienced, and not very smart. They're pulling the one, but I don't care about the rest of it. Again, first of all, it's projection. Inexperienced, not very smart. And then also it's like, they're the racists. It's like an attempt at political judo. No, it's not that easy, buddy. I know that you'd love it for it to be, but it's just not. And like to the extent that, what I love is, so he's the guy who secretly has a plan, and the right loves nothing more these days than implying that AOC is an idiot. And that's reality. It's whatever you want it to be. Whatever makes you feel good, that's American politics.
And that is happens to be what makes them feel good.
Exactly.
And a little of Trump's racism, because you just cannot, and you can no longer support this and then have it be something that is not you. So this makes every single one of, because we both read a piece this morning about how Pence and Trump and these aides, they're all really trying to focus on the GOP and make sure you stand by Trump. If you do, you're that. Yeah. And you can't. I don't want people to be able to. It's just so frustrating because I know that it's such a big possibility that they still will be able to be like, well, we didn't mean that, or that wasn't us. We were doing a job. We had to do this. I hope that every single one of them is not able to run from this.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you also can't run for your past. And so we're going to transition to a little bit of history going back in Donald Trump's past. Very interesting thing that was dug up over the weekend.
Yeah.
Donald Trump, back when he was hosting The Apprentice rather than hosting The Purge, he had an idea on how he could stimulate ratings. And he ran this idea past Howard Stern. And here's what it was.
It would be nine blacks against nine whites, all highly educated, very smart, strong, beautiful people, right?
Yes.
Do you like it?
Yes.
Do you like it, Robin?
Well, I think you're going to have a riot.
Yes, I like.
So that was his plan for a blacks versus whites season of The Apprentice. So literally just breaking people up by race.
Can I just say that I love that the craziness that Robin willingly sits through. Mm-hmm. That was a little too far. Do you like it, Howard? Yes. Do you like it, Robin? Well.
You might have
right.
Yeah. I guess, look, she's had to go through a lot sitting there for a long time. And think about it, at that point, what was that? What was that, the 30th time he'd been on Howard Stern at that point?
And she had to sit there. Something that was misogynistic or racist.
And
or
she's probably sitting there thinking, okay, that's crazy racist, but at least he's not talking about how hot he thinks his daughter is. It's a nice mix from that. Yeah. So it's actually even a little bit worse than it sounds there. He went on to say, I think that it would be handled very beautifully by me because, as you know, I'm very diplomatic. Adding that while there would be a mix of light-skinned and dark-skinned black contestants, the white team would consist solely of people with blonde hair.
I don't even understand this.
You do, though. You do understand.
Tell me.
You know what that's about. It's just he knows what he believes and he knows what other people believe out there. And he thinks if I can have just a little bit of like plausible deniability, have effectively a race war on TV. That's what he wants. He wants to preside over racial conflict. That'll be
where
a big winner.
He is the judge. He is the one who gets to pick who goes home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, look, you can say a lot of things about this, but his racial opportunism has been a constant throughout his life.
His
we could go through the history. We don't have time.
Sprinkling of racial animosity.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the tinge, the LaCroix-like essence of. Yeah, I mean, you can describe this in a lot of different ways, but what you cannot describe this as a guy who understands the history of racism in this country, cares about its ongoing effects, and will be serious in dealing with them. That's simply not a defense that can be levied against this.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, thankfully, in this particular case, NBC was like, no, we're not doing that.
Right.
But they did give him a platform, and they might have given him the presidency by allowing him to be a household figure day after day.
Over and over again, someone who would have those beliefs and thoughts. That's the thing. And we talk about this all the time and how like it's institutional because people who have these beliefs, as long as they don't wear a Klan hood and yell the N-word just randomly throughout the day, they're allowed to keep their jobs and things like that. Exactly. So somebody who is obviously racist has said something deeply racist, still remains on your platform. You just say, hey, no, you can't do that. You can't say that. Not that, you know what? The black people who are on this show, who work on this show, they don't deserve to have to be bossed around by you. They don't deserve the possibility that someone who thinks like you and speaks like you would treat them unfairly. Mm-hmm. That's why, you know, doctors and nurses don't lose their jobs. Teachers don't lose their jobs. Police officers don't lose their job. Lawyers, judges, they don't lose their jobs because they didn't, you know, wear a Klan hood to work and say the N-word. But all the other stuff, it's okay, but it still creates the same issues. And you're right, that was such a good point that he still kept his job as a host.
Yeah.
Just simply because we didn't really know about it.
Exactly.
Ugh.
I think that's a good point to end. We're gonna take a short break. We come back, lots more for you.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFDR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFDR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
More and more representatives are finding themselves on the end of a primary challenge, and today we have a new one. This is Richard Neal of the 1st District of Massachusetts now finds out coming into this week that he'll be facing a primary as well. And joining us now is the man who'll be challenging him, Alex Morse. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Thanks for having me on, John.
Glad to have you on. So look, we're gonna talk about Richard Neal, but I want to start off with you and your political history, which is actually quite interesting. So tell us about the path that got you to this primary challenge.
Great. Well, thanks again. I was born and raised here in Holyoke, Massachusetts. I went to the public schools, was fortunate enough to be the first in my family to go on to college. And at 21, while a senior at Brown, I announced my candidacy for mayor against the Democratic incumbent mayor who had been involved in politics for many years. So I know a couple things about being counted out and being told to wait my turn, that our work, our campaign is impossible. And, you know, Holyoke, we were the paper capital of the world. And just a lot of people had given up on the city and resigned themselves to the fact that our best days were behind us. And, you know, just as a young person that was a product of my community, I refused to accept the notion that we couldn't be the city that I thought we could. So over the last 8 years, we've really moved the needle on all sorts of issues. And, you know, now that we are in this moment in our country, post-2016 and seeing and reflecting on the victories of 2018, I've just been personally inspired to run for Congress in 2020 and start now and build the grassroots campaign over the next 15 months to represent the people here in Western Massachusetts.
So we've seen over the past few years the way that someone launching a primary challenge against almost any sitting Democrat, but especially Richard Neal is a particularly powerful one, chair of the House Ways and Means Committee. So you're probably going to be attacked as a result of this. You might already be experiencing that. In advance of those attacks, though, how would you describe yourself and your political philosophy? There's this battle going on in the Democratic Party. Where would you place yourself in that ongoing struggle to define the identity of the party today?
Yeah, I think people here in Western Mass have, and really around the country, have lost faith that government can be an incredibly powerful tool to improve their quality of life. And you have politicians that are more concerned about garnering years of service and power than actually delivering results and moving the needle on a whole host of issues. And so whether it's the opioid epidemic, healthcare here in Western Mass, the climate crisis, you know, if I felt like we had a member of Congress that was a progressive champion on the national level, partnering with mayors and local leaders and constituents that we represent, then I wouldn't be doing this. But I believe that government should really drive the conversation. And I've been inspired by a whole class of young progressive Democrats that are really moving the party and moving the country. So yes, he has power, but again, power for who? And you know, I tend to think that it's power for the wealthy and the well-connected and those that invest in his campaign. But what good is power if you're not using it to actually improve people's lives and advance policies that will make a difference in communities like mine?
Well, you mentioned that young class of congresswomen, and one actually, Ina Pressley, her successful primary challenge was not that far away from where you're going to be challenging Representative Neal. So let's turn now to Neal. In your initial advertising of this primary challenge, you describe him as absent, unaccountable, and unavailable. And you also point out the lack of urgency he seems to feel in his position. What would you say are some examples of him showing a lack of urgency and pushing for what his constituents would want him to do?
Yeah. I think, again, when I am in Congress, I think it's important to be in community, in partnership with people here. And that means having town halls and being accessible, being transparent. when I am on recess, not spending that time in D.C. or Boston wooing wealthy donors, but spending it with my constituents and the people that live here in Western Massachusetts. And when I talk about the urgency of this time, we can't pretend to continue acting like this is business as usual. I mean, we have a president that has changed every norm. Our democracy is dying before our eyes. And we have a member of Congress that is more concerned about preserving his personal relationship with the president than holding him accountable. And so I want to go to Congress to uphold the Constitution, begin impeachment proceedings to make sure that American people and people here in Western Mass actually have an opportunity to know the truth, to actually seize the tax returns that legislators in New York State have worked to make available over the last several months. And so when I'm there, I want to make sure to hold this president accountable and just stand up for my values. It's not enough to take the right vote at the end of the day if he does that. It's we need a progressive champion and a fighter in Washington to really change how Washington works.
Hi, Alex. This is Brooke Thomas here. So you talked earlier about power and the wealthy. And I had a question. I spent a lot of my childhood growing up in Northampton, Massachusetts. John is from Connecticut. So we know Massachusetts, formerly known as Taxachusetts. And I think Massachusetts has done a lot to kind of get away from that reputation. But what are your thoughts on Trump and other really rich Americans not paying their fair share of taxes in taxes? And what do we do about that?
Yeah, I think it's an absolute shame. Oftentimes we're asked how we pay for policies like Medicare for All or make sure that folks who want to go to college can get free public college or enough resources to actually address the opioid epidemic. But we don't ask how we can afford to give billions of dollars away to the wealthiest Americans and corporations. I mean, the fact that corporations like Amazon aren't paying any federal taxes, that people here in Holyoke and across Western Mass are paying a higher tax rate than some of the wealthiest people in this country is an absolute shame. And we need members of Congress that are less concerned about labels and left versus right, but really sort of the wealthy and well-connected and everyone else. And so we've seen the impacts of the way government works here in Western Mass. You know, as a mayor for 8 years, we've made progress on education, economic development, infrastructure, but we can really only do so much in the system in which we operate in that government isn't prioritizing people at the core of their policy. So I'm really excited to bring the perspective of a local official that has moved the needle and have acted in a progressive way on the local level, but really needing leadership in Washington that recognizes the struggles and challenges of the people here in places like this.
Well, of course, if our viewers would like to get a little bit of an idea of what you might accomplish, they can certainly look at your record as a four-term mayor of Holyoke. But in terms of your campaign right now, where can people go to find out more information about you and what you're running on?
Great. And I would just remind folks, we're not taking a single dime from corporate PACs, and we want to send a message loud and clear. We want to get more grassroots donations today than the congressman's seen over the last decade. And so people can go to alexmorrisforcongress.com, sign up for updates, and invest in this people-powered campaign.
Alex Morris, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I want to take a short break here. We come back, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez facing threats on social media. We'll break those down after this. Last week, when Donald Trump targeted Ilhan Omar, AOC, and other members of the squad with his constant racist attacks, we made the fairly bold prediction that considering what his base is like, some of them are going to take it a couple steps further, and there will be threats and possibly violence. Now, we haven't yet reached the violence, but the threats are coming in. Take a look at a message that was posted on Facebook by a police officer who said this about Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. This vile idiot needs a round, and I don't mean the kind she used to serve. You can see there he's responding to an article called Ocasio-Cortez on the Budget, We Pay Soldiers Too Much. We're going to respond to that because it's fake. But he says there at the bottom, it must be hard living with the IQ of a chiclet. So Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez needs a round. What he's saying is she needs to be shot. Mm-hmm. And that's a police officer, ostensibly someone who goes to work every day with a weapon.
With the ability to shoot people.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that's a fun way to enter the new week.
It's terrifying. If terrifying is means fun, sure.
Mm-hmm. And so before we return to this individual, Charlie Rispoli, we generally don't use
officer
individuals' names, but we're going to constantly mm-hmm. say that Officer Charlie right. Rispoli believes that it's a fun thing to talk about on Facebook, yeah. that he wants to shoot a congressman or congresswoman. So remember that this comes in the same year where we had different investigations, one showing thousands and thousands of members of the CBP, Border Patrol, ICE, all that in a group making violent, racist, and misogynistic and sexual attacks against AOC and others.
Yeah.
You also had the group of cops that was shown to be sharing racist memes, racist language, and things like that.
And by group, you mean
thousands.
Literally. Right, right. A giant, like a large amount of people.
All feeling very comfortable and secure in the idea that if they talk about these sorts of things, that it will not be a problem for
right.
them. That
no,
all the other cops on the one hand or Border Patrol officers on the other hand will think that it's totally cool.
Right.
Yeah. And for a very long time, apparently that actually worked until
yeah.
light was cast onto these areas.
Yeah, so yeah, this is scary and weird and it's creepy, but also there's so much wrong with this and how this is handled. One, just if we can just joke, his second comment saying she has the IQ of a chicklet while he, underneath him, not realizing that he posted, he clearly doesn't even know what the word satire means, because I could almost give it to him that even though this sounds ridiculous, if you are just so in your brain, you are just so, you just are so mad at them just for existing, that you could maybe be in a space where your brain doesn't operate, where you're able to like use logic and see that this is probably isn't something she said, right?
Well, why don't we describe that?
Okay.
So Raspoli's comment referred to a fake news story he posted to his personal Facebook page. The story's headline attributed a fabricated quote to Ocasio-Cortez saying, "We pay soldiers too much." The photo on the post is marked as satire and had been labeled false by the website Snopes on Wednesday, but Raspoli appeared to be upset by it. So he saw this.
He called
satire,
her dumb.
Fake.
That's the
it doesn't
irony.
Really, it seems less like satire to me than like just fake news designed to inspire outrage against her. This isn't The Onion or whatever. And he was so outraged by this fake news that he threatened the life of a congresswoman.
He did.
Devil's advocate. He thinks somebody should kill her. He thinks someone should kill her.
That's a threat. If you send me a tweet and say, I think you should be shot, that is terrifying to me. That's a threat. Mm-hmm. If somebody on the street walks up to a police officer in an argument, because obviously he is upset with this woman,
yeah,
and says, you should be shot, I believe 10 times out of 10, they will be taken into custody.
Yeah.
I just don't believe in his chief, which is upsetting, kind of said that, you know, he's distancing their department from these comments and then it's going to be dealt with, but also that he doesn't think it was a threat.
Mm-hmm.
It's horrifying. Your police officer wrote online that a sitting congresswoman, just that a human should be shot because she said something that he didn't like.
Yeah.
Should be shot. And this is what we're dealing with right now. A lot of times, this is the reason people are protesting in the streets, not because people just generally hate police officers. It's because police officers have more than too often, shot people for no reason. Because they were afraid, but there was no weapon. And a lot of times what it comes down to is because they were mad, because they were angry, because they were frustrated, because it was a situation and they wanted them to stop. A police officer in North Charleston shot a man in the back, a man who was running away from him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's because of anger. This is anger. A police officer is angry at someone and is saying she needs to be shot.
Yeah.
Because he's mad at her.
Yeah, and just think about how does he respond in other situations? I don't know anything else about his political beliefs.
Yeah, but he's giving you
and
this.
And yet I do know a lot about what he believes.
He's violent.
You don't just randomly end up sharing that sort of fake news and believing that this particular congresswoman should have been killed. And think about it. He believes that she should be shot. He also believes that she's stupid. How did he get to that point? I mean, that requires weeks and weeks and months of Fox News. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's Fox News and right-wing media that has gotten, like, normally you would think if a woman becomes literally the youngest person ever to be elected to Congress against a particularly powerful Democrat, my assumption would be, man, she must be something.
Right.
But they've been able to have it be twisted into thinking that not only was she able to accomplish all those things, but she did it while being stupid. And they do believe that as a result of a campaign to make them believe that. And perhaps violent ends will come
with this.
Also,
the campaign also being institutional racism that has existed since the beginning of this country, but sure.
Exactly, yes.
Like, you know, it's easy to believe Trump's campaign, his racist campaign, because that is, it's how this country works.
Mm-hmm.
It's how it is operated. That you call women of color, dumb. Mm-hmm. Black men, dumb.
And he just said this morning, actually. He said that the group of four were all stupid.
Of course.
Thankfully, this guy didn't kill her. The chief says he's not going to take it lightly. We'll see about that. I have a feeling this guy has a long career at that particular department. But
until he shoots someone who makes him mad and he gets office duty.
I was being sarcastic.
During the investigation.
But yes.
No, I know. I read your sarcasm that time. Okay, I was, see, we have, good, we have that know. Problem. We, yeah.
Okay. Yes, but like I was saying last week, a certain percentage of his base will cheer for these sorts of things. A smaller percentage will say she should be killed. A smaller percentage, but not zero, will do something about it. They'll send pipe bombs, they'll stockpile weapons and start a race war. We've already seen this multiple times. We're just waiting for him to inspire the right sort of psycho to actually act on it. That's the terrifying conclusion to this arc. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. We come back, lots more to get to. Homelessness is a major issue, not only in California where we shoot this, but across the country. Specific to here, did you know that in LA on any given night, there are almost 60,000 homeless individuals, the vast majority of which are completely unsheltered. The number is, of course, much higher if you go statewide and again higher across the country. And joining us now to talk about this issue and an organization doing a lot of great work to deal with it, Joel Johnstone, actor on The Marvelous Miss Maisel, a show that I absolutely love.
Pleasure to be here.
So you work with the Covenant House.
Yes, this is my first year working with the Covenant House. Mm-hmm. I was brought into this by our fearless leader, Rachel Brosnahan, who has been doing this for years now and is an active ambassador and advocate for the program, for the charity. And specifically what I'm doing this year is called The Sleep Out. And it's a section of the Covenant House where they get Broadway, New York film and TV industries to collaborate and help raise money and awareness for the Covenant House. And for those of you who don't know, the Covenant House is a program that provides the essentials, food, clothing, shelter, education, job training to our homeless youth in this country. Every year there are over 4 million homeless youth that they are trying to reach out to and provide everything necessary.
So I know that they operate across the country. So what are some of the ways?
In Canada and Latin America.
Oh, really?
As well, yeah.
Oh, I didn't know it was international.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
So as you point out, this is a monumental task. The numbers are obviously so high. So the sleep out, it's designed to raise money. What are you going to be doing with it?
We are actually going to be sleeping out for a night on the streets of New York in an act of solidarity with these kids who have been there and have found the Covenant House. And I'm as a first time participant in this, I'm excited. We're going to be meeting and listening to these stories and spending the evening with these kids. And I just, it's going to be overwhelming in every great way, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And the total goal for this chapter this year is $400,000. Anyone and everyone, I encourage you to please go to sleepout.org. You can search for my name, Joel Johnstone, or just type in Maisel. We have a whole team of participants from The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel who are raising money.
And it's amazing that the whole team is participating, but also that with her leadership, she's drawing more and more people in, and it's going to cast a lot of light on the problem, I
absolutely,
imagine.
Absolutely. I mean, Rachel is every bit as wonderful a human being as she is a talented actress. I mean, she's really just a really sparkling light to be around. She really is.
Are you originally from New York?
I'm originally from Wisconsin, Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Okay. Okay, because I was going to say, I mean, I imagine that in New York, especially, like, obviously the numbers must be quite high in terms of the total population and the teen population, but it's got to be even rougher than LA because, of course, the weather is far harsher.
I Milwaukee has a, you know, like a lot of big U.S. cities, if I can say Milwaukee's a big city, but it is larger than most, and it's got a terrible homeless population. And I remember as a kid, my parents tried to place an importance on teaching my sisters and I how fortunate we were to be a middle class family in a medium to larger city in America, and we would go to soup kitchens and shelters and serve the homeless because they really wanted to stress the importance of how fortunate we were and that this, for whatever reason, can be anybody.
Yeah.
And Milwaukee is you know, it's got the harshest, one of the most brutal climates for the homeless in this country.
It's hard to imagine.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we know here in LA, there's been a number of different efforts to do something about this, raising money, and we've had a few ballot initiatives over the past few years.
It's just staggering to me how the surge that we've seen in homeless in this city. And I know we don't have time. That's a whole huge thing to dissect in just this city alone, and it's happening all across America. Yep. And we are the richest country in the world. And if we can't guarantee food, clothing, shelter, education for kids, our most vulnerable kids, then I don't know what that says about
exactly.
us.
Exactly. I have a few ideas of what it says about us, and it confirms a lot of other things.
How much time do we have?
Yeah, exactly. So I want to talk about, we have some efforts to raise money, obviously great charities like Covenant House, that are working to help out these individuals. We also have some bold proposals like, I believe that New York has this presently, but it's being considered for California, a policy called Right to Shelter, where they would be obligated at the city or county level to provide enough large-scale housing to make sure that any homeless individual who wants to be sheltered can be, that it would be a requirement on the government. What do you think about those sorts of ideas?
I don't see anything, any reason why we shouldn't push full forward on that. Mm-hmm. I've been unaware of this. Is this on the initiative?
There's a few lawmakers in California that are talking about the possibility.
I love it.
Yeah. And
I would suspect, what's the backlash against that? I don't understand.
You might have some people complaining about cost or something like that. I'm imagining a lot of people living here probably assume that there is something like that. I said the numbers earlier. So 59,000 on any given night. These are the official numbers. God only knows what the actual numbers are. Mm-hmm. In LA, homeless, 45,000 of those are unsheltered.
That's right.
So we have obviously thousands of beds, but a relatively small percentage.
Covenant House provides almost 300 beds every single night in New York City alone, Manhattan, mm-hmm. just the borough of Manhattan. Yeah. And they're all filled almost every single night to youth, mm-hmm. to kids. We're not even including adults here. But, you know, I we're the richest country in the world. Why?
Yeah.
Why is this not an easy solution?
And it's got to be expensive. So if people want to participate and help out Covenant House, perhaps help you out in your sleep out, how can they do that?
They can go to sleepout.org, type in my name, Joel Johnstone, with an E at the end, or Maisel, just the word Maisel. You will find Rachel Brosnahan, a whole other list of our cast and other friends who are raising money for just Team Maisel. And then you can find other teams as well from New York Broadway film and television that are trying to get to this $400,000 goal this year.
Yeah. Can I ask you a more general question? Just because
please.
I'm always curious about this. We're in the middle of a weird time. And so you're an actor.
What do you mean?
I don't want to be specific. On this show, we don't point any fingers on the damage board. So, you know, you're on a very high profile show. You're in the public eye. At this particular time, how do you feel about, look, this is on sort of the periphery of politics. It's a political issue that can be dealt with politically, but you're dealing with it from the point of view of a charity. Do you feel any pressure to stay apolitical? In terms of your career, in terms of potential strike back, if you were to take a position on anything? I know certain types of actors are very outspoken, and others, it would be difficult to pinpoint what they think about anything that's going on. What do you feel about that?
I don't feel any obligation to hide any of my feelings. No.
None of the studios that you've worked with or anything, you've never gotten any sort of feeling that hypothetically
could be
bad?
No. And I... If there is something in my mind, something pressing, like homeless youth, mm-hmm. I am going to speak loudly and clearly.
Okay.
I've never felt that, and if I did, I feel like there'd be a little poke in my gut.
Okay. Well, that's a good feeling.
That. Yeah.
Okay, I'm very glad to hear that. And look, you're on The Marvelous Miss Maisel. It is honestly an amazing show. I've liked it for a long time. You guys were just nominated for a billion Emmys. And so not only are you getting the accolades you deserve, but you're also giving back. And so to everyone watching, please consider participating, not only generally in support of Covenant House, but also specifically in Joel's sleep out. Joel, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you here on a very important issue.
Thank you.
We'll be back right after this. Trump's relationship with the media so far as president has been combative, I think is a fairly safe way to say. You know, he kind of constantly calling them fake news and inspiring people to want to murder journalists. Some already have. And so it's been rough so far. And it's why I think we have a little bit more visceral of a reaction to this sort of statement. So I want to show you a tweet by Kyra Phillips, ABC Investigates correspondent, who tweeted, no matter what your politics are, I have to say that I appreciate the access real Donald Trump gives us on a regular basis and the ability to ask any question. A lot of people had an issue with that. I was one of them. Ben Mankiewicz on Twitter had a great response to that. So look,
what did Ben say?
So Ben had something about, you're pitching it as, isn't it nice of him that he allows us to ask questions when there is a constitutional responsibility for him to be responsive to the people and to the media specifically, and that the media have an obligation to play their role in our system in making sure that he's held accountable for what he does, that we find out what he's planning to do, and that all of this, the constitutional bedrock of our system, is being portrayed as a, isn't he a swell guy?
Right.
When he's very much not a swell guy, and his relationship with the media has been 100 times more conflictual and combative and hostile and dangerous than Kyra Phillips is presenting there. And so it seems like, best case scenario, this is sucking up.
Also, what a microaggression.
What's that?
Only a white reporter could say that after what he just spent the week saying to black and brown people in America. All the black people who work beside her every day, the photographers, the other journalists who have to stand up in front of this racist man who would get mad at them and say, go back to Africa. After that week, she didn't even realize that it just wasn't the time. And only if you are not personally affected, like it doesn't make you sad, make your stomach hurt, to know that there's a large amount of people in this country, one would say the majority, that believes that you are un-American just because of what you look like. Only someone who isn't personally affected by that would be able to, within that same week that the president tells black and Latin American women to go back to where you came from, would somebody be able to find something nice to say about him?
Yeah.
Like just in that moment, like I just, you know.
Sometimes I wonder, like I know, so I did the show, the main show with Anna not long ago, and we were talking about how he had been like fired up to attack Iran. What's that?
I just said black and Latin American, that wasn't factually correct, but anyway.
Okay, it's a live show, people understand. And how he backed off, and so like we should coddle him and be like, good boy for not attacking
Iran. He also lies to you, you get access, but he lies to you.
I don't know, I'm getting to that, so I wonder, is this an attempt to manipulate him? Like, he's really transparent and open to get him to be?
I don't think so. It really is just when you're just not affected by this stuff. You still get to do your job every day. Yeah. Your job is to show up and ask him the questions and try to get something out of him. And he gives you something.
Yeah.
And if you are not in harm's way, you can be fine.
Yeah.
I really think this is just someone who it lives in such a good space in this country right now
that they
just are oblivious
and doesn't get that other
to
people
to the harms. Right? That it's just that you can even find anything positive to say right now, and it's not, our humanity is not politics. So it's more, you know what I mean? I think that's what it is. I don't think it was a plan. I think she really truly believes that, hey, there's this good thing about him. Okay, great.
And then look, and the thing is, like, I did a little bit of research on Kyra Phillips, and she seems to have had a really impressive career, has been reported.
Exactly.
For a long
time, think it was manipulative or malicious,
Exactly. Married to John Roberts, that makes me question some things politically, but she does a great job, works for great, blah, blah, blah. But the thing is, like, everything that she said in that is just also, it's not just insipid and sucking up and brown nosing and all of that. It's also just 100% wrong.
Right.
When was the last time we had a press briefing? It was like 163 days ago.
Yeah, was it March?
Yeah, it might have been.
March.
And that wasn't even Trump. We're saying, could you at least send your liar to talk to us? Like Donald Trump does his particular version of it, where when he's walking, his only exercise, when he walks from the White House to his helicopter, he stops and you can ask him any question, and he'll turn it into a racist attack against whoever he's got a problem with at that particular time. He doesn't answer honestly or responsibly. He has frequently lied to your face, like when they asked him when he was getting on his plane if he knew about the hush money payments. He just said no. That was a massive lie. Seems like the sort of thing you'd bring up. If, yeah, I can ask him any question and he'll lie to my face. That's an issue.
Her husband defended her and he answered every single one of those. He said, yeah, somebody was like, but he lies to you. No, someone said, you know, he hasn't held a daily press briefing. And he was like, well, you know, we'd much rather have direct access to the president. He answers questions even out of the country. Okay, when he answers, he lies to you. Well, you may not like his answers, but at least he's willing to give us some. What?
Look, if the case
we deserve better than that.
Okay, so this is a bigger problem. We're not going to be able to fix it on today's show. But yeah, John Roberts and Kyra Phillips, you're not frustrated enough and at the right people, I would say. Thank you as always.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. Thank you everybody for watching. Gigantic week planned. We'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.